as if in agreement. Something had happened. There had been a breakthrough. Oskin plopped down in his chair, and his friends around him eyed him nervously. Now a younger man asked for the chance to speak. He said his name was Konstantin Yazovsky, and he represented a work collective. "Our collective doesn't want to approve this man, Yuri Ivanovich," he said. Yuri Ivanovich, for his part, was now squirming in his seat in the front row like a man with the bends. Yazovsky went on. "We don't know his program or what he'll do. What is he for? What is he against? Our opinion is that we need him as a factory director, but only that." The boos rolled over Yazovsky like a wave, and the undertow of hostility brought him sliding back to his seat. But then there were some cheers here and there, then catcalls and arguments in patches of the crowd. The meeting had gotten distinctly out of hand. With a nod from one of the assistant directors in the front row, the chairman snatched the microphone off its stand and said, "Well, I guess it's time for a vote." But by now there were enough voters in the hall who knew something was wrong. The present seemed too much like the past. This time they would not be deceived. They would not be fooled or ignored. There were insults from every direction. Of course, no one had any illusions. There would be no alternative candidates, no rebellions, certainly. But there was at least a feeling, an insistence, that the appearance of democracy had to be served. "A vote?" one man shouted from the back of the hall. "All our lives we've been raising our hands. Let the man tell us who he is and what he stands for before he gets our vote." And so, finally, Yuri Ivanovich Kirillov spoke. This was his magnificent concession to the democratic process. He said he didn't mind the criticism, though it wasn't very pleasant to sit through it. He made no mention of a platform in his long, rambling speech. His only idea for reform at the national level was his firm intention to build a recreation center for the workers of the Red Proletariat machine tools factory. The applause was polite. The chairman got his way, and there was, at last, a vote. 308 for Kirillov, 10 against, and 7 abstentions. The hands went up slowly, more in concession than affirmation. After all, what choice did they have? No one was prepared to rebel. The idea did not yet exist. At least not here, and not yet. The catcalls, the insistence on hearing the candidate, had been rebellion enough. The electors filed out of the auditorium in silence, guilty and downcast, as if they knew they had not gotten things right, and did not yet know what it was they had to do. The Communist Party, of course, wrote the election laws for the 1989 elections to ensure that it would have the vast majority of seats. And that is the way it turned out. More than 80% of the 2,250 deputies were party members, the vast majority of them local secretaries, military officers, and other loyalists. The reason was simple. Every imaginable party front group, from the Komsomol to the Union of Stamp Collectors, was guaranteed a raft of seats. Only one-third of the deputies would come from open races. In conservative regions, especially Central Asia, single-candidate races were the rule, not the exception. This was not a democratic election, Sakharov told me. It was a rigged quasi-democracy. The only oases of democracy were where the system was somehow imperfect. In those few spots where the elections were imperfect, meaning open, the establishment party candidates invariably lost. Central committee members, admirals, generals, apparatchiks of every sort, suffered the humiliation of public rejection. Such was the case in the October region when Comrade Kirillov was one of a half dozen apparatchiks who didn't even come close. The runoff came down to a popular and not very intelligent television commentator and Ilya Zaslavsky, a textiles engineer, not quite 30 years old, who walked on canes and spoke in a barely audible mumble. Zaslavsky, running on a platform of general reform with an emphasis on the rights of the disabled, won easily. When the Congress opened in May, Zaslavsky was one of dozens of young liberals who had gotten into politics only because they had finally seen a leader they thought they could trust. Zaslavsky, Arkady Murashov, and Sergei Stankovich of Moscow, nationalists from the Baltic states, Armenia and Georgia, environmentalists from Ukraine, Byelorussia, and Siberia, they all had seen the elections as an opening. That period, just before and after the first Congress, was a time of euphoria. These were days when radical Democrats thought that reform of the party was not only possible, but the only route to change. Somehow the chance of a reactionary counter-revolution seemed academic, remote. That first session of the Congress was an endless series of astonishments. In the opening minutes of the Congress, Sakharov ambled to the podium to make the first speech. Later on, Sakharov would make specific proposals about the creation of a multi-party system and a decree on power that would lead to constitutional democracy. But now he kept his remarks general, trying, it seemed, to serve simply as a model of patience and openness. But the Congress quickly became something hotter, as if the crises of 70 years could wait no more. What followed was an explosion of public debate and revelation. A former Olympic weightlifter, Yuri Vlasov, blasted the KGB, saying that the secret police ran an underground empire in the Soviet Union and had not reformed at all. A law professor from Leningrad, Anatoly Sobchak, attacked the generals and party officials who had sanctioned and led the assault in Tbilisi against a peaceful demonstration in April 1989, which left at least 19 people dead. Yuri Karyakin, the Dostoevsky scholar, called for the removal of Lenin's remains from the mausoleum on Red Square and for their decent burial. The liberals in the Congress also were beginning to make clear they would criticize Gorbachev, even oppose him, when they thought it necessary. When Gorbachev was put up for election by the Congress as chairman of the legislature, an obscure and slightly woolly delegate from northern Russia, Alexander Obolensky, nominated himself. "It's not a question of winning," he said. "It's a matter of creating a tradition of political opposition and competition." The action in the hallways during the frequent recesses was almost as dramatic as the speeches inside. At first, the young Soviet reporters watched with amazement as the Westerners walked up to the most powerful men in the country and pestered them with cameras, tape recorders, and notebooks. Within a few days, the Soviets were getting the hang of it. For the first time in their careers, members of the Politburo and leaders of the military and the KGB were subjected to embarrassing questions. For decades, no one had dared ask them about the weather, much less the erosion of the Communist Party. Now they were being chased to the bathrooms and the buffet tables for their opinions, for accountings of themselves. Gorbachev quickly mastered the art of spin control. Accidentally on purpose, he would wander into a huge crowd of journalists just after the lunch breaks, make his case, and disappear. Vremya, of course, would run his comments in full, giving him the role as both chairman and media commentator over his political creation. Sakharov, for his part, endured interviews with a wistful patience. The camera lights, he must have understood, were part of modern democracy. Everyone talked and talked, or almost everyone. "Day after day I stalked Viktor Chebrikov, the head of the KGB until 1988, a man with a gnarled face and the posture of a Roman emperor. As he paced the halls, very few deputies dared approach him. Those who did say hello were grasped by the elbow and taken off to a private corner. Chebrikov would not talk where other deputies or foreigners could overhear him. I kept after Chebrikov, and at first he shooed me away as if I were a small cloud of gnats. When I would not go away, he said, "We'll talk tomorrow," or "after the next break." Finally, toward the end of the session, he said, "Mr. Remnick, there will be no interview." Strange, but I had never told him my name. No one in the country could tear himself away from these televised sessions of the Congress of People's Deputies. No newspaper, no film, book, or play had ever had such an immediate political effect on the people of the Soviet Union. The sessions were broadcast live for 2 weeks, and factories and collective farms reported that no work was getting done. Everyone was gathered around television sets and transistor radios. People simply could not believe what they were hearing. Though the reform-minded deputies were in a distinct minority, no more than 300 or 400 out of 2,250, they were much more savvy about getting to the microphone, and Gorbachev was usually eager to hear from them. It was only when someone went beyond the barriers of the official conception of perestroika, most famously Sakharov's demand for a repeal of the party's hold on power, did Gorbachev grow impatient and call for the next speaker. Gorbachev ruled his Congress with the swiftness and guile of Sam Rayburn in his House of Representatives. When Sakharov's criticism exceeded Gorbachev's tolerance, he dropped all pretense of democracy. He switched off the microphone and sent Andrei Dmitrievich to his seat. The reformers were overcome with a sense of triumph and possibility. While the session was on, they had seen the Chinese leadership order the slaughter of hundreds of peaceful demonstrators in Beijing. And they had the sense that, for once, the leader of the Soviet Union was not the same sort of butcher. Vitaly Korotich, the sly editor of Ogonyuk, walked with me toward the Kremlin gates, talking of how the conservatives were in for a crash, how the country had changed in just 2 weeks. "The people in this country have always been afraid of power," Korotich said. "Now, maybe, the powerful are becoming a little afraid of the people." By the end of the session, the conservatives in the Politburo were impossible to find. They were finally embarrassed and tired of all the criticism and challenges. They made liberal use of their private, guarded entrances and exits, and were rarely seen on the way from the Hall of Congresses to their waiting limousines. But for all the exhilaration of the elections and the catharsis of the Congress, no one had any idea what it would lead to. From start to finish, the Gorbachev era was an improvisation, with alternating dull spots and high-wire periods. Until now, the politics of the country had gone unseen. Politics had been a matter of the Kremlin, the closed, untelevised sessions of the Politburo and Central Committee. The gulf between the state and the individual was unbridgeable. Even the huge street demonstrations in Yerevan and the Baltics went nearly unreported in the main party newspapers. But now almost everyone had seen the accumulated anguish of 70 years broadcast live. They had become familiar with the ideas and personalities not only of the country's leaders, but of Sakharov, Zaslavsky, and Afanasyev of Moscow. They had seen a bookish Estonian woman, Mariu Laristan, challenge Gorbachev's authority as if it were almost normal. They had even seen a half-articulate cab driver named Leonid Sukhov take the podium and warn Gorbachev that, like Napoleon, he was being led by the nose by his own Josephine, his wife Raisa. Another deputy demanded that Gorbachev answer for his new expensive dacha on the Crimean coast. Until now, Kremlin power had run on mystery as well as might. The Congress had ended all that in 1 2-week-long television extravaganza. The Congress hinted at something new, a revolution from below. But what form would it take? Who would lead it? And when? Little more than a month after the Congress closed and Moscow shifted into its mode of summer torpor, perestroika spun out of control, first in the coal mines of Siberia, then in mines all across the country, from Ukraine to Vorkuta to Sakhalin Island. After July 1989, the Kremlin could never again have any confidence at all that it was the master of events. After July 1989, the illusion of a gradual Gorbachev-directed revolution from above was over. The revolution from below began when a group of coal miners in the Siberian town of Mezhdorochensk walked off the job at the Shevikovo mine, led by their shift leader Valery Kokorin. The main issue was soap. The miners were angry, too, that their equipment was pitiful, that the work was wretched and underpaid, that food supplies were meager and benefits non-existent. But what galled them most was the grit in every crevice of their bodies, the inability to come home from work and wash themselves clean. There was no soap. All around the Kuznetsk Basin, the Kuzbass of Siberia, in Mezhdorochensk, Prokopievsk, Novokuznetsk, and Kemerovo, miners had been grumbling for years among themselves. They had never dared take their protests outside a small circle of friends and family. Their poverty, like the poverty of the farmhands in Turkmenia or the steelworkers of Magnitogorsk, was simply the way things were. But within 12 hours of the walkout in Mezhdorochensk, nearly every mine in the Kuzbass was on strike. You cannot imagine how off the cuff this was. It became so enormous so quickly, but it started from almost nothing, one of the miners at the Severovo mines, Ilya Ostanin, told me. Soon the strike spread to Vorkuta in the far north, to the Don Basin, the Donbass, in Ukraine, to Karaganda in northern Kazakhstan, to Sakhalin in the far east.
Gorbachev went on television looking stricken and exhausted, but still pretending to complete mastery. He had no choice but to try to make the strikes his own, to describe them as a healthy manifestation of a very young democracy, and then pray they would end before the railway workers, collective farmers, or oil riggers got any ideas in their heads. He could not control an entire nation in rebellion. Even the conservatives in the leadership could not ignore the miners. The miners had the ability to shut down heavy industry and force the Kremlin to contemplate what a long, cold winter could mean. After a 5-hour flight and a 30-minute ride through the Siberian taiga to the city of Kemerovo, I got my first glimpse of the working-class rebellion. In Armenia, I had seen hundreds of thousands of demonstrators on the streets, and almost as many in Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia. But there had never been anything quite so dramatic as this, nothing that had so vividly illustrated the disintegration of the workers' state and the changing mind of a broad sector of the people. In a hard afternoon sun, miners dressed in their work gear, tens of thousands of them, sat in the main square of Kemerovo outside the headquarters of the local government and Communist Party. "Get up and show your anger," one sign read. "The Kuzbass is not a colony," said another. When some of the local party officials took the microphone to tell the miners that the strikes were hurting old people and school children, they were shouted down and booed off the podium. The local party press denounced the strikes, but one local television host, Viktor Kolpakov of Kuzbass Day by Day, read straight, informative reports on the strikes around the country every night at 8. The Siberian miners had an instinctive sense of media and imagery. They made for great television, and they knew it. Though they were not working, they came to the meetings dressed as miners, smeared with coal dust, wearing their helmets and gritty work clothes and boots. At dusk, they created an even more spectacular image when they turned on their Davy lamps. It seemed as if tens of thousands of huge fireflies had invaded the square and gone into a frenzy. The speakers, of course, took their turns under the feet of the city's biggest statue of Lenin. The irony was lost on no one. At first, only a few strike committees called for a solidarity-style union. The initial demands were economic. More soap, detergent, toothpaste, sausage, shoes and underwear. More sugar, tea and bread. Vacations and a regular work week were at stake. Not Gorbachev. He still represented for the miners a shining possibility, a figure of integrity. Almost everyone was careful to praise him, or at least show a measure of respect. One of the speakers, Pyotr Kongorov, a member of the strike committee in Prokopievsk, said that while ecological conditions and the standard of living remain a focus of despair in the mining town, people are not blaming Gorbachev. They know they are able to strike because of Gorbachev. But on the other hand, they are waiting. And we can't wait forever. There had been strikes before in the Soviet Union, bus drivers in the city of Chekhov, airline pilots who refused to fly until safety standards were improved. But the symbolism of the miners' strike was extraordinary. The miners embodied the vanguard of the proletariat, a bastion of Bolshevism in the old days. To look out at the great crowd of them in Lenin Square was to see a kind of poster for what had once been called the masses. And now the masses were walking off the job and declaring that socialism had not delivered anything, not even a bar of soap. Soon the word came to Siberia from Moscow that the coal ministry was ready to promise more supplies, higher salaries, and other benefits. At a huge public meeting in the Kemerovo city square, the miners gathered to hear the details and vote. They heard promises from Moscow's emissaries that planes would soon land, loaded to the ribs with soap, meat, lard, cooking oil, and detergent. Salaries would be increased, vacations lengthened. Most of the miners were relieved. At least for now, they had reached the limit of their daring and were ready to go back to work. They were ready to believe Moscow. Some miners warned that the deal would fall apart, that Moscow was up to its old tricks. But when it came time for the vote, nearly everyone agreed to end the strike. Tens of thousands of hands shot into the air to vote yes, to accept the deal. That night, workers arrived at the Yagunovsko mines for their first shift. They seemed happy to be back, but wary, as if they were already losing conviction in their decision to return. "I'm down in these mines for 39 years, and I'll walk out again without any hesitation if Moscow tries to go behind our backs," said a tunneler named Leonid Kalnikov. "I believed in communism, once our great dream, and now I believe in the power of our strike. We're not very experienced with this, but we are ready to learn." Kostya Doyagin, who had worked in the mines near Kemerovo for 7 years, said that with the 35-point settlement worked out between the Kremlin and the local strike committees, "we've won a small victory, but it's still small. We have to wait and see if they deliver." The miners did not get much done that night. Mostly they stood around in the offices and down in the shafts, talking through what had happened in the days before. Even in the beautiful summer weather, the villages near the Yagunovsko mines were dismal places, more miserable than anything I had seen in West Virginia or the north of England. The miners and their families lived either in tiny wooden houses, shacks with a tin chimney, or, more often, 2- and 3-story apartment flats known as barracks. Families were packed into these dwellings, and somehow they could not keep them clean. No one took the garbage away. There was no hot water. Indoor plumbing was rare. In winter, that meant a trip to the outhouse in temperatures 40 degrees below zero. Men confided that they and their wives were humiliated that they had to make love in rooms while their children were sleeping, or pretending to sleep. They had not been able to buy contraceptives of any kind for months. "The abortionist is the busiest man outside the mine," one woman told me. The children in the villages seemed to have no toys and wandered through the streets, playing army, hurling sticks and stones. They were filthy, and their teeth were already yellowing. Their parents' teeth were rotten, and the lucky ones had caps made of brilliant silver or gold. They all looked older than they were. Men in their 50s who had just gone on pension were hunched over and sinewy from crawling through the mines and swinging a shovel since they were 15. They wore greasy jackets and caps. When you shook their hands, they felt like a fighter's hands, rough and pillowy, swollen from too much work. Their eyes were vacant and filmed with rheum. The women, at least the ones who worked above ground, seemed to have more spirit in them, but not much. They were women who, after a certain age, had seen their husbands fall sick or break down and die. It was a miserable life. Near the mines, I saw a 10-year-old runaway begging for coins. There were ration coupons for cooking oil, butter, vodka, meat, macaroni, and fat. There were coupons, but not always the products themselves. The main grocery store near the Yagunovsko mines had nothing but canned tomatoes, oatmeal, and rotting cabbages. People didn't go hungry, but they did not have enough. Many people told me they got by mostly on bread and macaroni. Sausage was a twice-monthly treat. One morning, my cab driver swerved crazily, nearly plowing into a tree. He pulled over to the side of the road. He was disoriented and knew it. He apologized, saying, "I haven't eaten much in a while." The drugstores were empty unless you counted the bottles of leeches and the jars of aspirin. An old woman named Irina Shatokina, who worked 20 years underground as a ventilator specialist, told me that one of her friends had had a mild stroke and could not get the medicine he needed. "Because of that," she said, "he is now a vegetable." If there were pleasures in the life of the miners beyond those of good talk and family, I did not see them. The most obvious pleasure killed them. In the morning, retired miners lined up at a vodka truck, and seconds after they'd made their score, they drained the bottles. When they could not get the real thing, they made moonshine out of everything from hair tonic to canned peas. I saw one drunk lying in the street drinking water out of a puddle. Everywhere the air was thick with gas. Around the mines, the leaves on the trees were filmed with a gray dust. One pond in Kemerovo was so thoroughly contaminated with toxic waste that municipal workers got rid of dead stray dogs by throwing them in the water. After a few days, even the bones disintegrated. The mines themselves pretended to be offices. Blocking the view of the elevators and the open pits, there was invariably a brick office building where the engineers and administrators had their cubicles and the workers had their lockers and showers. There was the illusion of going to work instead of plunging straight down to hell. I met a few men outside the headquarters of the Yagunovsko mines one afternoon and asked where I could find the director. I wanted permission to go down the coal shaft. "Why do you want to bother with the director?" one of them said. "He'll just tell you a lot of shit and send you on your way. Come with us." The miners took me inside to the locker room. I stripped to my underwear and T-shirt, and they gave me a full set of gear. Without a moment's condescension or mockery, they showed me how to wrap my feet in long white bandages and pull on black rubber boots. The miners' suits were made of heavy fireproof cloth, a thick canvas, and felt strangely light. There were thick rubber gloves that made your hands sweat, a plastic helmet, an emergency oxygen supply, and an extra flashlight. The miners flipped on their suits easily. They had spent most of their waking hours dressed like this and underground since their mid-teens. We walked clunkily down a set of stairs and outside to the elevators for mine number 6. The iron door slammed shut, and, packed shoulder to shoulder, we began our descent a quarter mile into the Siberian earth. 30 miners dressed in greasy coveralls stared at their boots, then at the dents in the ceiling. Irritable, still half asleep, they shuffled and fidgeted. It took a while to get to where the coal was. Their helmet lamps darted nervously in the dark. There was no talk, only coughing and a few long yawns. The elevator went down and down, and my ears ached, then popped. The iron walls rattled against the shaft. Finally, we hit bottom, and the door opened onto a labyrinth of dark halls of stone. A blast of cool air from the ventilators hit us in the face. It was the freshest air I had smelled since arriving in Siberia. "Sometimes this town stinks so bad that the air down here is better than the air up there," said Leonid Kalnikov. Even before the day's mining had begun, his face was black, and I supposed mine was too. As we walked through a long tunnel, Kalnikov said he was 60 years old and kept working because his family could not survive on his pension. There was no other way for him. He had no illusions. "I'll probably drop dead down here one of these days," he said, without self-pity. 40 years before, he had been a young, muscular man and had helped build this shaft, digging through the stone and putting up steel struts. "Now almost all the coal is gone," he said. "It's got some years left, but it's just about dead. I'm not so eager to stick around for the last lump. But maybe I have no choice." During the strike, the mine had been neglected. The labyrinth of alleys and tunnels and chutes had filled with water, which made the walking all the harder. As we made our way down the main shaft, we began to stumble along through water a foot deep. The bottom was like the muck at the bottom of a pond, and after a few minutes my boots were filled with bits of coal, sharp-edged chunks that began to slice my ankles and blister the soles of my feet. Not one of the miners said a word about it. Along the way we passed men, many of them in their 50s and 60s, tucked into crevices and cracks only a couple of feet high. They lay on their backs or in some other contorted position, chipping at the coal face or repairing some part of the support structure. When they opened their mouths, coal dust would fall in. The men who had been working for an hour or more were completely black, and all you could see in the half-dark was their flashlights, their eyes, and their teeth. I glanced into one corner and saw 3 miners, black figures in shadow light, and they did not move or speak. They were on their 10-minute break. After a long walk, how far I could not tell, we reached a tiny rail car, a steel contraption that rides on tracks through the mine shafts. The metro took us another 4 miles farther along the mine, rumbling and rattling along like the 7th Avenue local in New York. "It's about the last chance you get to relax all day," one of the workers said, as he slumped in his seat and caught a nap. He slept soundly and then woke with a start when the brakeman put an end to the reverie. Once the work began, there could be no relaxing. To relax, to let attention drift, could mean a horrendous accident, an explosion, or a collapse. The miners lived with this fear all the time. Each year, a few men died at every mine in minor accidents, the sort that are never reported in the news, the undramatic kind. It was November when the mine last blew up. Vladimir Gaponyuk, who put in 24 years underground, told me he remembered the strange, muffled sound of it. It was close to silence, but you knew exactly what had happened. Someone broke a safety rule. Then a stream of methane caught a spark, and in the end, 4 miners were crushed to death. "We've got accidents like that all the time," Gopanyuk said. "We lose a couple every year." Outside the mine shaft, there were two posters. "Hail to the work of the 27th Party Congress," and "We need your hard work, but what we need most is you alive." Valentina Alisovna, a member of the Mines Party Committee, was one of my guides. She watched me listen and take down the long, numbing litany of complaints. The horrible work conditions, the danger, the disgust with a life that goes nowhere. Party leader or not, she seemed ashamed, and at one point her eyes filled with tears. "We live like pigs, I'm sorry to say it, but it's true," she said. "The mine is a century behind the times. When we go home, we can't count on electricity. The water goes out on us. I'm no capitalist, but it's obvious this system has done nothing for us." All the miners were listening and nodding. Alisovna's comment hung in the dank air. I had thought this had not been a political strike. This is what I had been told. No one said anything, and we got down on our knees and crawled through another tunnel. The ventilator wind whistled across the stone. In the afternoon, while more teams of miners tried to clear the shafts of water and sludge and to get production moving once more, the Yagunovsko Strike Committee met in a wooden shack where the Communist Party Committee had its offices. Across the country, the strike committees had become the center of political power at the mines. The party and the official unions were doomed. Six men and Valentina Alisovna sat down to a table, the inevitable portrait of Lenin staring down over them. A poster on the wall read, "The party is the mind, honor, and conscience of our epoch." Everyone was anxious. They had some sense that all of the Soviet Union and all of the world had seen the images from the mines of Siberia, Ukraine, and beyond. But the strike committee had no idea of what would come next. There was no pleasure in their voices, only the suspicion that they were about to be betrayed, the conviction that there were more strikes, more trouble ahead. "Look, it's a long time before we have any real money in our pockets from this strike," one of them said. "We have to watch out." The talk bounced around the room, picking up speed and fury all the time. "No one's paying any attention to the fact that this mine is the worst around the Kemerovo region. It's exhausted. There are two villages to feed, and we're going to be out of coal in a few years. Some of the mines have no coal left in them at all. We've got to talk about redundant work. 60% of us are working, and 40% are standing around supervising or smoking cigarettes upstairs." "Not true. People are breaking their backs down there." "We need a united front. Obviously, our union is nothing. And we can't stand alone. We're just one little committee. We miners have to unite, form a real union or something. The Politburo can't do everything for us. Perestroika has to move faster. Maybe we need new tires. It's time to get rid of the bosses. We don't need them. We have to answer two simple questions. How are we going to live? And what do we do now?" The meeting lasted an hour. Afterward, I walked with the shift leader of Mine Number 6, Anatoly Cheglov, a huge man with a broad smile and mouth filled with gold teeth. The day had begun for him at 5:45 in the morning. He woke in his izba, a small log cabin 2 miles from the mine, and took a look at the Kuzbass, the morning paper, for more news about the mines still out on strike. His address was 2 Second Plan Avenue. "In the summer," Cheglov said, "it was easier to get out of bed. The sun was already high. At least you can walk outside without snow up to the waist in the dark," he said. Now the kitchen garden outside his door was rich, green with basil and cucumbers.
Shcheglov said he ate a lot of cucumbers. Raw or pickled, there's not much else. He opened his refrigerator, a squat primitive thing that buzzed, and searched it for something for dinner. It was filled with food that he was lucky to have. A grayish roll of sausage, a few eggs, a cabbage, a cut of pork that was no less than 3/4 fat, a half bottle of vodka. Lucky because the stores were nearly empty. Nearby, at fruit and vegetable store number 6, known as the best in town, Anatoly went looking for something more to eat. The groceries available were these: half-brown cabbages, rotten tomatoes, cans of tomato juice and sardines, salt, and jars of pickled cabbage. And at the State Products Store, off Johann Sebastian Bach Street, there were more half-brown cabbages, more rotten tomatoes, smelts, 5-1 chickens, bins of white bread, and sacks of dried corn. To do better, they say here, you need blot, or connections. The only way to do better was to make a deal, to trade a bottle of home brew for a bag of decent carrots, an auto part for a cut of meat. The only other way is to buy from the private market, Anatoly said, and the prices there are impossible for anyone but a party big shot, the guys who have the dachas down the road. About a half mile from Shcheglov's place was a prison camp. Prison 1648-043. Every day the convicts, thieves, rapists, murderers, were shuttled in railway cars between their cells and the zone, the work camp. People in town despised the prison, mainly because when the convicts were released, they said, they took jobs at the mines and the factories nearby, and many of them went back into crime. But I'm not so sure it's a bad thing, Shcheglov said. We have 3 guys down in our mine who were prisoners there. One of them stabbed his wife in the stomach. Another beat someone over the head. I think he killed him. And another guy's wife was involved in some sort of scandal, and so he beat her to death. But they served their time. They work all right. During the Stalin years, Shcheglov's father was thrown in a labor camp for 10 years for no crime at all. Anatoly remembered the day Stalin died, and how everyone around, even those with parents and friends in the camps, wept as if the world were lost. It was March 1953, he said. I was a young pioneer, and we always wore those orange scarves. They gave us black ones to wear. And when the teachers started crying, we cried too. Children always imitate the emotions of their parents. Shcheglov was no radical. He heard the news that the miners in Vorkuta, in northern Russia, were still on strike and demanding an end to the party's constitutional hold on power. I'm not sure that's right, he said. He was a trusting man who spoke with only the slightest bit of irony when I asked him about the effect the dust had on him after working in the pits for so long. My lungs, he said, taking a long drag on a cigarette butt. The doctors always tell us our lungs are fine. They give us a checkup every year. And why shouldn't I trust the doctors? If you can't trust them, who can you trust? For years his dream had been simple. Finish working at 50 or so, take his pension, and move outside of town to the taiga, the vast Siberian forest. What he wanted from the strike, he said, was just the chance to live decently, to have a cake of soap or toothpaste when he needed, to eat a cut of meat worthy of the word, to wear a pair of shoes that could last 6 months, and to have the chance to earn a profit if, by some miracle, his work brigade could squeeze some extra coal out of mine number 6. And then, when it was time, he'd move out to the forest, where the fishing was good, the air was clear, and life was lived above ground. I'm used to the dark, he said. But enough is enough. The Siberian miners had no single leader, no Lech Walesa. The unions were a farce. They did not protect the working man so much as they ensured his passivity and obedience to the party. That had been Lenin's design. Lenin declared Western-style labor unions narrow-minded, selfish, case-hardened, covetous, petty bourgeois. The unions under socialism, he said, would be conveyor belts of the party. One of the first things the miners did during the strike was to box out the union leaders and set up strike committees. Taking their cue from the miners, all kinds of laborers set up workers' clubs in the Baltics, Byelorussia, and Ukraine. And in Russian rust belt cities like Magnitogorsk, Sverdlovsk, and Chelyabinsk. But there was no Walesa. Probably Walesa had been a particularly Polish phenomenon, a figure able somehow to unite workers, Catholic clergy, and urban intellectuals. Anatoly Malikin was as close as it came to a Walesa in the Soviet miners' movement, but because of the vastness of the country, his influence was mainly in western Siberia. Malikin was an eloquent tunneler from Novokuznetsk. He had the muscular, squashed-down, weary look of a man who had played fullback for 1 year too many. He was in his early 30s and looked 10 years older. All that was left of his hair was a kind of monk's tonsure. Malikin said he was a congenital enemy of the people, a bitter joke. His grandfather, a Cossack, was arrested in the purges of 1937, and his father, as a child of an enemy of the people, was deported to Siberia. Malikin's mother, a Ukrainian, was also a political deportee. For years, he said, he had led the same unconscious existence his father had, that everyone around him did. There was never any thought of protest, much less mutiny. Miners were serfs in a patrimonial system in which the lord was the Communist Party, and its instruments were the schools, the trade unions, the mine directors. Our system and our propaganda didn't allow people to grow as individuals, to ask questions. We were raised to be uninterested, Malikin told me. We had no idea how the state was run. We went to elections having no idea what they were about. They told us, "You are a small man, a punk, and why should you care? You just do what your boss tells you." The principle was this: I am the boss, and you are an idiot. If you tried to argue, even slightly, you were immediately thrown to work in the worst spots. You were crushed, humiliated. We are still dogs with three different kinds of collars: green, yellow, and red. They are the colors of the passes to the mine, and they can be changed or taken away for the slightest violation. Everyone violates the rules sometimes. That is the only way you can work with the equipment we have. So if they don't like you, they seize on that and you'll never work again. People who tried to preserve their dignity were crushed and thrown away. This is not a life for human beings. We have no time for leisure. We have no decent clothes. We spend our entire lives making just enough to feed ourselves and our children. The shift starts at 6 a.m., so you have to be up at 4:30. You go to the mine, work 8 hours underground, and all your life is work. When you come home, you are too exhausted to do anything but collapse. On the weekend, there are chores to do at home. About the only leisure we have is a mug or two of beer in the morning after the night shift. That's it. And then you quit, if you haven't already been killed in an accident. A few years later, your lungs give out or your heart goes. Bye-bye. You're dead. In the coming months, I went to mines in Ukraine, Sakhalin, and Kazakhstan. As it became clear that Moscow would not, and probably could not, come through on the economic deal, I heard more and more miners and other workers talking about a political strike. They were giving up on the system. But I had also heard those very things on the afternoon before I went back to Moscow from Kemerovo. Another of the workers at Mine Number 6, Ivan Narashev, invited me home. His hut, at 6 Krupskaya Street, was smaller and even plainer than Shcheglov's. He could barely control his anger. He had voted against going back to work. "We should have stayed out until there was money on the table," he said. "We should have been like bulls and waited until we got exactly what we wanted." Hunched forward in his pine chair, Narashev talked about how the party big shots were trying to break the strike with sweet words and no deeds. He remembered being on the town square in Kemerovo one afternoon at the height of the general strike meetings, and seeing the local KGB chief hovering near the speaker's platform. "I'll tell you, I'm only 37, but I'm ready to go for early pension," he said. "I've had it. 10 years underground is enough for me. I'd like to get a car and put my wife and kids in it and drive away from here. Somewhere where the air doesn't burn your eyes. We should have had these strikes years ago. We've been destroyed by Stalinism and Brezhnev's cronies. I'm ready now for a leader other than Gorbachev. Someone more like Boris Yeltsin. Yeltsin's a man of concrete deeds. How is it possible that until now our leaders eat all the pork and we chew on the bones? If Yeltsin were sitting where Gorbachev is, maybe it would be different." What seemed to burn in him most was the feeling that the strike would turn out to be not the glorious victory that everyone at Mine Number 6 was saying it was, but another humiliation, like gray sausages and no electricity. It was not yet clear that the miners' strike of July 1989 was the first and most dramatic step in the creation of a link between the revolt of the intelligentsia in the cities and the nationalists in the republics with the political uprising of workers across the country. "Think about this country for a minute," Ivan Narashev said as the room began to darken. "Our leaders have always divided us, kept us down. I think they're doing that now, and they will rule again." Chapter 15. Postcards from the Empire. Valentin Falin, a rumpled, weary man high up in the Central Committee apparatus, was always prepared to serve the party. But now he had an impossible task. With Eastern Europe beginning its democratic revolution, with evidence of the same in Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, he was instructed to go before the press and deny the existence of a Soviet empire. The Kremlin had long since given up trying to rein in Eastern Europe. "We made that decision in 1985, 1986, Yegor Ligachev, of all people, told me. "We already had the example of Afghanistan before us." This is not to say the Kremlin was overjoyed with the triumph of Solidarity or other non-communist parties in Eastern Europe. Officials in the Kremlin simply could not believe that the Eastern Europeans were rebelling on their own. Ligachev told me that had it not been for Western provocateurs, the Eastern Europeans would have chosen reformed socialism and not bourgeois democracy. The leadership had hoped for Eastern Europe what it hoped for itself, the victory of the Communist Party's liberal wing. "I am confident," Gorbachev said in an interview with the Washington Post in the spring of 1988, "that the vast majority of people in Poland favor continuing along the path on which the country started after World War II. But no matter how disappointed the Soviet Communist Party was in the nature of the Eastern European Revolution, it could not afford intervention, not if it was going to get Western support for rebuilding the Soviet economy." Moscow, however, was absolutely determined to hold together the Union, the internal empire. The preservation of the Union, Gorbachev said repeatedly, was a last stand. And yet his strategy was all muscle-flexing and expulsion of wind. The threat of force and a fraudulent argument that all the republics, including the Baltics, had joined the Soviet Union willingly and happily. For all his democratic pretensions, Gorbachev never saw the Soviet Union as an empire, a product of Tsarist and Bolshevik conquest, but rather as a multinational union. He saw the Union as inexorably linked not only by economic ties, shared history, and intermarriage, but by an ineffable sense of commonality. Gorbachev portrayed himself as a kind of Soviet one-worlder, and the proponents of republican independence as retrograde nationalists doomed to the tribal battles of centuries past. "We are looking ahead," he told the Lithuanians, "and you are looking to the past." To preserve the Union, the party was still willing to use its airbrush on history. The leaders of the Baltic independence movement, backed up by nearly every reputable Western historian, argued that Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania came under the Soviet sphere of influence as a result of a secret deal between the Kremlin and the Nazis. The Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of August 1939 surreptitiously divided Europe into Soviet and German spheres of influence. One of the secret protocols gave Moscow control over Latvia, Estonia, and parts of Poland and Romania. A second protocol, signed a month later, gave the Kremlin control over Lithuania. In 1940, Stalin annexed the Baltic states and forced their puppet legislatures to request admission into the Union. And now Valentin Falin, chief of the party's international department, was on the stage of the Foreign Ministry Press Center telling us that even if there had been such protocols, so what? They had nothing to do with present realities. Falin's excuses would have shamed a schoolboy. The dog, he seemed to say, had eaten the secret protocols of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. When perestroika began, Gorbachev had at least some sense of the deterioration of the national economy and the difficulty of creating semi-democratic politics in a totalitarian state. But he and his colleagues started out nearly oblivious to the nationalities question. In December 1986, Gorbachev fired the Kazakh party chief, Dinmuhamed Kunayev, and replaced him with an ethnic Russian, Gennady Kolbin, never anticipating that the people of the republic would object. The ensuing riots in the republic's capital, Alma-Ata, eventually forced Gorbachev to replace Kolbin with a Kazakh. But the incident did not seem to impress the Kremlin very strongly. Even the massive demonstrations in Armenia and Azerbaijan in early 1988 seemed to Gorbachev a matter of local interest, a petty squabble over Nagorno-Karabakh that could be resolved by replacing the local party leadership. He saw no threat there. After all, hadn't the protesters in Yerevan carried portraits of Gorbachev? But the Balts spoke more clearly. Their demands were easier to discern. They began with demonstrations about the environment, then about the need to preserve Baltic languages and cultures. Step by step, the Baltics grew more political, more self-confident. By early 1989, the most popular politicians in the region were non-communists, and by May, the parliaments of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania had all declared their sovereignty. It was unclear what sovereignty meant or could mean. Even the leaders of the main opposition groups, Sąjūdis in Lithuania, the popular fronts of Estonia and Latvia, were careful not to talk of outright independence as anything other than a remote goal. When they spoke of independence, it was in the wistful tones of scientists planning on the colonization of Mars. "We cannot afford illusions," said Marju Lauristin, a leader of the Estonian Popular Front. Lauristin least of all. Her father had been a leader of the Estonian communists who welcomed Stalin's annexation in 1940 with open arms. At first, the Kremlin had not seemed so threatened by the Baltic republics. They were, after all, a special case. Minuscule states absorbed into the Soviet Union more than 20 years after the Bolshevik Revolution. And, just as important, there was the matter of temperament. The Balts were calm and measured, reasonable. Their demonstrations, next to the huge and noisy marches in Yerevan, Baku, or Tbilisi, were as gentle as a Save the Whales march on a summer's day in Sausalito. The Balts were more European somehow than the rest of the Union, and their traditions of small-scale farming and business, Gorbachev supposed, might even set a healthy example in Russia. But the Baltic example became the model not for the revitalization of the Union, but rather for its collapse.
In the 3 years it took to win independence, the Balts were never violent, only stubborn. It was that very temperament, Sakharov's calm confidence on a mass scale, that characterized their evolution. None of the other republics organized quite so well or thought with such precision and cool. At first glance, the idea of Lithuania standing up to Moscow sounded like an episode from The Mouse That Roared. It was too comic to consider. Sayuri's headquarters, a small building near the main Catholic cathedral in the capital city, Vilnius, was filled with well-scrubbed volunteers. They had a couple of PCs, a fax machine, satellite phones, and sweet wall posters showing Balts holding hands and singing songs. One afternoon I watched as a young woman, wearing Birkenstock sandals and humming a Tracy Chapman song, pumped press releases through the telex machine and sent them to news bureaus all over the world. She was announcing a demonstration for August commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. I thought of how blithe she seemed next to the traditional Bolshevik image of real revolutionaries, sweaty, bearded men in the Smolny denouncing factionalism, Lenin speaking from an armored car, the stink of bad cigarettes. And yet she was their master. Here she was, playing a vital role in the creation of a mass movement that would eventually liberate Lithuania and give the rest of the Soviet Union ideas. In their public statements, the leaders of the Baltic Popular Fronts had a knack for echoing Gorbachev's own rhetoric, and then applying the principle to their own situation. When the Central Committee issued a threatening statement directed at the Balts, the Popular Front groups in the region issued a counterstatement that sounded much like Gorbachev's address to the United Nations. "The time when military force can solve everything has long since passed. Tanks are not only an immoral argument, they are no longer omnipotent. The main thing is that such a turn of events could once and for all put the Soviet Union back into the ranks of the most backward of totalitarian states." The Latvians, Estonians, and Lithuanians were keenly aware that for Moscow, the price of violence would be much higher than it had been in 1956 or 1968. This time Moscow made no secret that it needed the help of the West to survive. A bankrupt empire would be forced to shrink. That equation gave the Balts their confidence, a confidence that was shaken only when the governments of the West were weak or tardy in their support. How can there be a threat of tanks when there have already been Soviet tanks in the Baltic states for 50 years? Said Trivimi Velista, president of the Estonian Heritage Society. "Tanks will not help them, even if they do move them into our city streets. The only thing they will do is cause a lot of trouble for our road repairmen. India used a passive resistance, and India became independent in the end. In terms of that kind of strategy, we can learn a lot from India." In Lithuania especially, you could see with the greatest clarity the Baltic strategy. The Estonians, the saying went, were the brains of the movement, the Latvians the organizational spine, and the Lithuanians the heart, the moral force. The key leader of Sąjūdis, and eventually the president of the republic, was Vytautas Landsbergis, a man of almost infuriating confidence and righteousness, a moody academic who drove Gorbachev and even George Bush to distraction with his disdain for playing politics and moral compromise. A musicologist at the Vilnius Conservatory, Landsbergis was no less a pedant than Gorbachev himself. When the Lithuanian parliament, in what seemed like a moment of fantasy, took up the question of a national anthem, Landsbergis went into a long discourse about how the song could not be sung, as it had been traditionally, in the key of F sharp. "No one can sing that high," he said, and thus launched into a long disquisition. Like many other intellectuals in the Baltic states, Landsbergis had not lived the dangerous life of an outright political dissident. But unlike the older Moscow intellectuals who worked within the party and saw its reform as the only avenue of change, Landsbergis kept his distance from officialdom. In the years before Gorbachev, he saw the preservation of the Lithuanian culture as the only possible political act. "If we could keep alive the language, our religion, the culture, everything Moscow was trying to kill, then we had a chance," he said. Landsbergis's cultural dissidence was a family trait. His maternal grandfather, Jonas Jablonskis, was a linguist who fought for the primacy of the Lithuanian language after it was banned by the Tsars. His paternal grandfather, Gagrielis Landsbergis, was arrested and deported by the Tsarist government for the crime of writing for an underground newspaper. His father, Vytautas Landsbergis Sr., was an architect during Lithuanian independence who fought in the resistance against the Nazi occupation. In the years of stagnation under Brezhnev, Landsbergis himself tried to preserve Lithuanian culture by studying the music of the composer Mikalojus Sirlionis. When the political opportunity came in 1989, Sąjūdis and Landsbergis led a cultural revolution, a revival of historical memory. "I was in Vilnius to see a political act that would, in the next few years, become the ultimate symbol of the return of history. I saw members of Sąjūdis, after a vote of parliament, ripping down the signs reading Lenin Street along the main drag in Vilnius and replacing them with signs reading Gediminas Street, named for one of the great dukes of Lithuanian history. The highway between Vilnius and Kaunas was changed from Red Army Avenue to Volunteer Avenue, celebrating the volunteers who fought for Lithuanian independence in 1918. On Sunday mornings, Lithuanian television broadcast Catholic Mass on a new program, Glory to Christ. The young quit the Komsomol and the young pioneers. The Lithuanian Communist Party even conducted its sessions in Lithuanian, a great departure from the days when sessions were held in often clumsy Russian, the Soviet language." Western visitors, still flush with Gorby mania, would, with increasing frequency, come to Vilnius and hope that they could bridge the differences between the Kremlin and Sąjūdis. No matter how distinguished the visitor, Landsbergis would greet such attempts only with weary condescension. "We are an occupied country," he told me once. "To pretend we are grateful for a little democracy, to go through some sort of referendum to prove our commitment to independence, to talk with Mr. Gorbachev as anything other than a foreign leader, is to live a lie. It is very simple. We are an occupied land. Only now we can say it, of course. But we have never considered ourselves a genuine part of the Soviet Union. That is something that Gorbachev does not quite understand. We wish his perestroika well, but the time has come for us to go our own way." In the end, the Baltic strategy was excruciatingly simple. They would speak the truth and then press the Kremlin to make good on its own moralistic rhetoric. As Gorbachev himself had done, the Balts defined their direction by first clarifying the facts of history. The secret protocols of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact made clear that the Baltic states were occupied as part of a geopolitical deal with the Nazis. The second step was a matter of logic. If the occupation was illegal in 1939, then it had always been such. Therefore, the Baltic states need only reaffirm their independence. Once they had established this logic of revolution, the other Baltic leaders followed Landsbergis's strategy and spoke of Moscow as a foreign state. Nearly all the Baltic representatives in the Soviet Parliament suddenly declared themselves interested observers rather than deputies. They also played a kind of moral game with Gorbachev, insisting on his goodness, his distinctiveness. "We in the Baltics look on Gorbachev as the good Tsar and try to pretend that the Tsar doesn't know. It's his ministers who are up to mischief," said Andres Reid, a television journalist in Tallinn. "In a way, we are playing a political game, using Gorbachev's name. He is an anchor for us, a shield, a shelter. Of course, we disagree with him on some things, but we try not to be too harsh about it. We have no one else looking out for us in the political hierarchy. We have nowhere else to go for help." The Balts were determined to prove that they were tougher than the Kremlin, that their moral certainty would result in either victory or annihilation. Perhaps what gave them their confidence, and what distinguished them from most of the rest of the Soviet Union, was that the Lithuanians, the Estonians, and the Latvians enjoyed and remembered a legacy of at least intermittent independence. The Lithuanians, for example, had been dominated by the Danes, the Teutonic Knights, the Swedes, the Russians, and the Nazis. But there were periods of freedom, most lately between 1918 and 1940. In the most recent period of domination, under the Soviet Union, Stalin deported hundreds of thousands of Lithuanians to Siberia and replaced them with Russian workers. But now the Baltic leaders would not accept a middle ground, for the middle ground meant continued occupation. And they were right. The Kremlin capitulated, slowly, step by step. On July 23rd, Alexander Yakovlev, as chairman of a legislative investigating committee, conceded the obvious. The secret protocols existed. Landsbergis could not help but be amused. "This announcement," he said, "comes to us as a great shock.